Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to this week's Charlton Live podcast. My name is Louis Mendes. I hope you're well and you're making the best of this tough situation that we find ourselves in at the moment. Another week with no football, of course, but that's no reason not to have a Charlton Live pod. We'll chat about the latest news at the Valley and, of course, have another stroll down memory lane. So on this week's pod, I'll be joined by Terry Smith, Nathan Miller and Benji Cloak as we discuss the relatively small amount of news that's come out of the club this week. We'll also chat about the release of the Sunderland Till I Die documentary. It just so happens to have a happy ending for us. And with the club streaming the highlights of the hugely successful 2011-2012 League One winning season on the website this afternoon, we decided to share our memories of that superb campaign and listen again to a classic interview with the man that made it happen, Sir Chris Powell. So let's dive straight into this week's chat with the lads. We hope you enjoy it.
Charlton Live.
Right, so that time of the week again, time for another Charlton Live podcast. Delighted to say on the phone this week. First of all, let's bring in Benji. Benji, how you doing?
Yeah, all good, thank you, Louis.
Yeah, how you finding the lockdown?
Yeah, I'm still able to do little bits of work, so not too bad out of normality, but yeah, badly missing the football, especially on a nice day like today.
Yeah, exactly. I wish I could be outside just watching any game of football. Who else have we got? We've got Terry. Terry, haven't heard from Tel in a while. How are you getting on, Tel?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks, Louis. Hope everybody's surviving the craziness we are in at the minute.
Yeah, how are you finding it? Because obviously you must be in one of those groups where you're not allowed to leave the house at all, I'm guessing, with your age.
Well, exactly, and most people have been avoiding me at least 2 metres for most of my life, so I've had quite
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no different for you. And of course, we can't have a Charlton Live pod without Nathan. How you doing, Nath?
Living the dream.
Yeah. How the trees? Have they changed at all in the last couple of weeks? Or
couple of leaves. You know, it's mate. Couple of leaves. Been talking to a couple of them.
Yeah, we've had some excitement. We've one of our tree in our garden started blossoming now. So, not seen that before. Yeah. So
what's that's. Your name?
I'll send you a photo later on, actually, for your collection.
What, of the tree, or...?
Yeah. Wait, if you've got any requests, let me know.
Good to be back, mate.
Yeah, good to have you on. Right, I mean, obviously, lads, it's been a fairly quiet week on the Charlton front, maybe. I think the only thing we've seen of any interest was a statement on the club website that came from Tanun Namir, from Claudio Filarica, and from Marian Mihail. I'll just read out a quick bit of that. And so they say they appreciate it's a difficult time with the COVID-19 crisis that has changed the world for everybody. For Charlton fans, there's also been uncertainty around the future of the club with a lot in the press and posted on social media. Well, yeah, Tanun can talk on that front, can't he? It says, going forward, the board of directors will look to keep you as up to date as we can through the club's official media channels, which is probably a good thing. We must begin by reiterating that our commitment is to Charlton. The club is not for sale, and the majority shareholder, His Excellency Tanun Namir, is not looking for a buyer. So obviously, refuting that story that was in the Evening Standard last week. These are tough times for any professional club, and we are 100% focused on seeing Charlton through this difficult period. This will require investment, and the first instalment of that investment will come in April. The club has submitted documents to the EFL for approval to demonstrate the source and sufficiency of funds. The club has also submitted documentation for the new directors, Claudio and Marian, for the owners and directors test. The EFL remains supportive and have informed us of what remains outstanding. The club will remain in contact with the EFL with the aim of providing the necessary information as is required by the league as soon as possible, so we can successfully conclude matters. We will get everything sorted and football will return, but until then, we wish all Charlton players, staff, fans and their families the very best in their trying time. So that was a statement that Tanun, on behalf of the club, I guess you could say, put out on, was it Monday, Tuesday. Terry, I'll bring you in first. What are your initial reactions to that? I guess because we've had a few statements now over the course of the last month or so, and I've been saying this every week now, it's now more about action than statements, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in isolation, it's a nice enough statement. It tries to calm our fears. And so if it was the only one we'd had, you'd probably think, oh, okay, yeah, we can live with that. That's a nice soundbite from the club. But sadly, it's not in isolation, is it? We've had months of stuff going on backwards and forwards between various parties, including the club. And, yeah, you're right. I mean, what we need now is for something to happen positively from, I guess, from the EFL to say, yeah, everything's tickety-boo. Till that happens, we're all still not knowing what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, how confident are you feeling about this? I've asked a lot of the other guys on the pod over this over the course of the last few weeks. I mean, what is your gut feeling now, or do you feel it's still too early to say? I mean, do you think time's probably running out for these guys to come and prove themselves now?
Yeah, I don't think I should go on my gut feeling. I've been eating and drinking far too much nonsense in lockdown for the last couple of weeks, so it's probably not right to go by my gut. But I don't know. I think the heart still wants it just to be about the source. I mean, I think that's what everybody's saying, is the source of funding. I don't think there are too many question marks, although people still have, that there's money there. How much is an issue, but it's the fact that where it's come from, and the EFL have got one of these tests that say, unless you can prove where it's come from, and it hasn't come from ill-gotten gains, and bearing in mind that one of the board members that we've just put on the board has got a payback £10 million for things he didn't do quite right some years ago. Mm. Doesn't bode well, does it, really? So that's one side of things. The other side is this: the suspicion that, I mean, anybody who's as old as me will remember the Nigerian tyre rubber company, and it smacks of that. You know, that there's promises, but nobody's entirely sure that it's legit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's hard to tell at this moment in time, isn't it, Benji? I'll bring you in. What's your gut feeling? Obviously, was it 3 weeks ago now since we had that show in my kitchen where, you know, that was the end of the first week of this absolute nonsense, and it's still dragging on. I mean, I'm guessing at that point we were saying we'd hope to start to have some sort of clarity within the next couple of weeks, but it's still sort of hanging over us, this issue, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's good we've got no games happening at the moment, because I'm sure the off-the-field struggles that we're seeing at the moment would make their way onto the field in the way that I don't know if the protest would step up, because it is looking worrying that we've still not come to a resolution. Tanoon is still promising that he will put this money in, but we're still waiting. So, I don't know. I think the other week I was hoping that the ex-directors would step up with their case, that they're trying to force through that this takeover doesn't happen, and believe it or not, would be back in the hands of Roland. And I still think I'm behind that, really, because it just seems like all words from Tanoon, maybe a power battle to say, look, I've got back the club website now, I'm going to start posting on there. At least it's been a quiet week in regards to social media from Southall and Tanoon, that we haven't seen any of that, because it was getting a bit silly. So hopefully everything's happening in the background that we can just finally get to a resolution of what's going to happen.
And obviously he talks about putting money into the club in April, so obviously we're into April now, because that's clearly something that has to happen quite soon, because it's quite obvious that the money's going to run out, especially with the lack of games being played, Ben. So, I mean, he needs to come through with that sooner rather than later, otherwise we could be in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it's up in the air as to when the games will start again. So he's got that kind of time on his side. But yeah, I mean, us as supporters, we're just looking for that confirmation that we're going to be all right as a football club. And of course, there might be clauses in the contract of the players that, look, if they haven't got paid in so many months, and they could just walk off, and our club could be falling apart. We just, as was said on the show last week, these guys need to stop their own little personal battles and just focus on the main thing of providing these funds to secure our football club. Nothing else matters. in regards to them mouthing off to each other. It just really needs to focus on securing the club's future.
Nathan, I mean, obviously it has been a slightly quieter week, as Ben mentioned there, in terms of the social media handbags, which is probably a good thing. But I mean, are you feeling any more confident that this is going to sort itself out?
I don't really know, mate. There's so much stuff going on at the moment. I've just not really thought about it, to be honest. I mean, the last week or so, I've obviously with stuff with Sebo and that was last week, or and then and obviously since the Sunderland documentary's come out, now it sort of kicked sort of the interest in Charlton again for me. Anyway, I mean, because I said last week it started getting a bit boring with the mudslinging and all that, and I sort of switched off from it all really, and I was just like, you know what, let's just crack on and get on with it. Sitting up, you know, getting this isolation business out of the way, and then, you know, hopefully the games will come soon. But I mean, gut feeling, I mean, the proof's going to be in the pudding, isn't it, really? It's you know, he's got to put the money in, he's saying he's going to. So, like everything at the moment, we just got to sit and wait, haven't we? So I don't really know what else I can say, you know, as well as what the other fellas have said. But I mean, yeah, it's going to be one of those where hopefully he does, and then when the game's starting again, if he puts it in, we can sort of fund ourselves. Like Benji and Terry said, you know, there's no money coming through in the gates, nothing coming through into the club, nothing commercially, so he's going to have to put his hand in his pocket rather at some point.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not great that obviously the EFL are a bit of a closed book on this sort of thing, Nathan. They play their cards close to their chest. So you can understand why, perhaps, from their own point of view, they're not going to give too much away when it comes to revealing where they are at any stage in a process that they have to go through. But it does sort of mean we're sort of sitting here in the dark waiting to find out. You know, we don't know if the EFL have got issues with the documentation they have now supposedly been provided. You are sort of just waiting for news now, sitting patiently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't really know the whole structure of the EFL, but obviously in light of recent events, I think their attention has been geared towards sort of liaising with the Premier League and that sort of stuff to try and get some sort of uniformed stand on the situation at the moment. And it doesn't surprise me that our situation with Tanoon and that may have taken a backseat, I don't know. But yeah, I don't think they can be too transparent about it, because there are certain things that, you know, that need to remain private, especially with funds and stuff and people's personal details. But I mean, it's hard because obviously everyone wants to sort of know what's going on. But if nothing's actually changed from what we know, then there's no announcement to be made until there is something that's done. So we can only go by what, you know, the statement said, that they've submitted the details to the EFL and the EFL have told them what's still outstanding. So we just have to wait now and sit and see when we've got the A-OK, shall we say.
Yeah. And Terry, I guess one other point that was interesting in that statement was the denial that the club was going to be put out for sale, because obviously we talked about this on last week's pod. The Evening Standard had a story that Tanu Namir was looking for between £2 and £4 million to move on the club, and then obviously whoever took over the club would then have to enter into their own sort of agreement with Roland Duchatelet for the purchase of the Valley and the training ground, which has then since been denied. Obviously, in the current climate, I imagine there's not too many people looking to go and spend a load of money on a business that literally is getting no money in and is hemorrhaging money at the moment. Do you read too much into that comment? I mean, obviously, if you are looking to sell the club, you'd pay it close to your chest a little bit.
Well, that as well, but I mean, you'd have to be slightly on the left side of weird to buy a club for £4 million that only got sold for £1, and you didn't actually own anything within it. So that's one thing. But secondly, I mean, you just get the feeling with all the other stuff that's been going on, it's just been a fed by, you know, from a certain area, that sort of story. In the same way as we were ground sharing with Palace and moving to the peninsula and all this sort of stuff, it's the sort of thing that you just don't trust anymore, put it that way, because you don't don't know where the sources come from, and currently there are so many different sources with different agendas. You just I tend to ignore them, to be honest. Just ignore all of them until we get it's sadly we're in a position where we'll only know when we know. It's not a question of guesswork anymore, because there's so much stuff out there. We're only gonna really know when it materializes.
Excellent stuff. Right, so look, I think we've drawn a line pretty much under the very little that's gone on this week in terms of the battle for power at the Valley. But there is some other stuff I wanted to bring up now. Anyone who, like me, is currently just sitting at home with nothing to do, they would
Nathan, because he's talking to trees.
Yeah, they would have been delighted to see the release on Netflix of the Sunderland Until I Die documentary, Benji. I don't know if you've had a chance to watch it, but it's fascinating, really. I mean, obviously, I did watch the entire series because it is quite interesting to see how the day-to-day running of a football club goes on behind the scenes, one that isn't ours and therefore could be described as ever so slightly more normal, although they still had their issues. But obviously, the thing we were waiting for was seeing that day at Wembley all over again. But it is bizarre. I don't know if you've watched it yet, Ben, but it's absolutely bizarre to see it from another point of view, because obviously, I mean, I was crying at Wembley, tears of joy, but to see some of those fans with genuine tears of sadness in their eyes, it was quite quite interesting to get a different view of it. It's a view that perhaps, Ben, that we hadn't really had to think about before.
Yeah, I haven't got around to watching it yet. I've got a few other things I'm watching on Netflix, so I was trying to build up the excitement until I watched it. But yeah, I mean, I must say, watching it from a different perspective will be quite good. I've seen a couple of their YouTube videos from a couple of their fans that they put on. And I mean, the whole moment for me was just so surreal. It didn't seem quite Charlton-like, because I was just waiting for extra time to happen, and to win it how we did, and then it just to be over was quite extraordinary. But I must say, I think their fans were the best losers I've ever come across. Like, where I was sat at Wembley, I was on the halfway line, so I was like quite close to the segregation between them and their fans, and had quite a lot of them during the game. Obviously, when they went 1-0 up, they were giving it to us. When it went 1-1, we was like, "Hey!" And then when we won it, obviously, limbs everywhere, everyone going crazy, tears down my eyes, everyone going mad. And full time, looked over to them, and nearly all of them come over, thumbs up, shaking our hands, and and you were with me in the pub afterwards. We was having a sing-song with them. They were all in good spirits. And to come all that way down for Sunderland for a second time down to Wembley that season, I know the documentary depicts that, and to lose it like that, I mean, if that was me, I would have been straight out of the stadium. So fair play to them. They are great fans.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it, Terry, like the way that we've sort of built up this rapport with Sunderland as a club, going back to what happened in 1998, and I'm sure they'd rather have the chance to prove that they're gracious winners, but they have proven twice now over the years that they can take losing on the chin in the right spirit, I guess.
Yeah, you do wonder, and I haven't seen the whole documentary. I've dipped in and out a couple of the episodes, so I've seen a bit where they were talking about pre-match music or walkout music, which was surreal, and then watched the reaction of the fans while the game was going on for Bauer's goal. So they're the only bits I've seen. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we had a decent reaction from them back in '98, and I didn't come across too many Sunderland fans this time around, so I don't know what they were like this time around. But you just get the feeling when they knew it was they were playing us, their hearts must have hit their boots. I mean, I haven't seen it all, whether or not there was any pre-match predictions, but they must have thought, "Oh, why do you hold? Fancy doing that for us again?" So that, I think maybe that might have stood us in good stead in the game. Who knows?
Well, it's funny enough, actually, one of the kit man at Sunderland is the same kit man that's been there ever since 1998, and there was a clip of him sort of saying, he not saying that he felt it was a good omen, but he just felt like it that they would get us, and he hoped they'd get us. So they obviously he was sort of slightly upset by the end of it. Nathan, again, I don't know if you've had a chance to see any of it yet, but it even seeing it from that different perspective, I could watch anything to do with that day over and over and over again. So it was nice. It was something that a lot of us have been looking forward to.
Yeah, no, I haven't had a chance yet.
I'm off
work for 3 weeks, start from the 14th, so I'm probably going to save it till then. Because what I'm trying to do at the moment is try not to do everything straight away, because then I'm just going to run out of things to do. So I'm holding off at the moment. But I'm looking forward to it. Obviously, the last bit. But even if we weren't on, it's going to be at the end of it. I think the first season was really good. I think it was a really good insight. I think the Leeds one as well was good. I think it gives a good little insight of how clubs run and how you've got different characters and stuff. And just going back on what Benji said, I mean, obviously, the fans there are absolutely unreal. Obviously, we speak to Roker Report a lot, who do the similar sort of thing. I speak to Graham quite a lot, who does a similar sort of thing for up there. And they're just nice people, you know. Every time we went up there and stayed up there, went out, they're just nice people and really, really just football fans, you know what I mean, really working-class football fans. And although we're going to be successful in the end, you know, they are a nice club, and it's a shame that it didn't end as nice as it could have, but, you know, well, we were there, so I don't really care. I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a good little watch. A lot of people have said it's good. I've seen some bits on Twitter. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so there is some interesting bits on it. And one really fascinating bit was sort of transfer deadline day in January, where, of course, we all know they go on to end up signing Will Grigg from Wigan for an extortionate fee. And it's quite obvious, actually, what's revealed, that Jack Ross, the manager at the time, he sort of said on the phone to Stuart Donald or to whoever, saying, you know, don't break the bank, it's really not worth it. And Stuart Donald's there making his mind up and thinking, no, we won't. And then at the end, absolutely falls for Wigan's games and end up paying a lot more money. So it's quite interesting to see how that sort of stuff goes on behind the scenes, and, you know, the egos in place in a football club, and how they sort of bounce off each other, and how, you know, a football manager might try and make a decision, but then someone who's above him might then try and make a decision on his behalf and maybe go on and make the wrong one. So it's interesting. It was also interesting, the Roker Report, they do show a bit where the owner and the CEO went on an episode of their podcast, and it's quite clear, I think, that the Roker Report knew deep down that it wasn't Jack Ross's choice to spend that amount of money, and they're trying to force the chairman and the owner to admit that. So it's fascinating to watch how these things are at play, Ben, in football clubs, and to get a real insight into how things go behind the scenes. And I guess, I mean, everyone's been saying it for weeks now, you just wish that Amazon or Netflix had picked us for their one, because some of the behind the scenes conversations over the course of the last 5 or 6 years would have been a sight to behold if there was a camera in there recording it all for us.
Yeah, as you said, it is extraordinary. I remember in the first series, it was quite interesting to see Johnny Williams was the star of the show then. And we saw he had quite a battle with his mental health because he'd been having some bad injuries. I must say the most enjoyable part of it is how managers work through transfer deadline day and the lead up to that, because obviously Sky Sports hype it up so much. I think it was Simon Grayson was their manager before, and I think he was getting quite desperate to sign someone. It's interesting you say that their manager wasn't behind that deal, and it was more the owner. We as fans, we signed Josh Parker, and we were watching Sunderland sign Will Grigg, spending big money, and we were like, oh no, look, they're going to sign all these players, and we're just signing Josh Parker on a free. We were worrying, but at the end of the day, it turned out as it did, and maybe Bowie had more of a say at the club, more as maybe Jack Ross did at Sunderland. I know we didn't have the money as much as they did, but it turned out well in the end for us. So maybe Jack Ross looks at that kind of thing, and maybe there's too much pressure on Grigg's shoulders.
Excellent stuff. So yeah, I definitely recommend the Sunderland Till I Died documentary for anyone who hasn't seen it. I actually signed up to Netflix specifically just to watch that, but it was certainly worth it. Now, obviously we're still sat indoors, very little chance to get out and about, and it does make you bored. one way of putting it, I found myself making a full working model of the Championship League table on Excel that you can put your own scores into, And you can even do a points deduction. So I gave Millwall an 80-point deduction, and that put them bottom of the table. But that was just to keep myself entertained. But if anyone who was aware of what the fixture list would have been if we did play today, we're actually due to play Millwall today, Terry. So in a way, we sort of dodged a bullet there.
Yeah, the unbeaten run goes on. well, sort of. Yeah, I mean, some great things on Twitter and the Charlton Life Forum about what we would normally be doing round about now. We'd be training our sorrows because obviously we haven't kicked off yet, but we know what's going to happen. and then some people saying, yeah, but I've got a new ritual now. Instead of going to watch Millwall, I'm doing this. And then only for somebody to come up and say, I think I didn't see who the contributor was, but say, yeah, but then you've got to stay indoors for 30 minutes and let your Millwall family the next door go past you. All this sort of stuff. So it's keeping it just Twitter's kept me entertained, I've got to be honest. And the wife's family jobs to do, so I can't wait for football to go back.
Yeah, it's going to be weird, isn't it, Nath, when the football does finally return? Because, you know, obviously we were on a bit of a poor run just before the games were ceased, as it were. But, I mean, even if we lose our next few games 5-0, I think I'll just be glad just to be out of the house and just to get back into some form of routine.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, when we was talking about it the first time, we'd done the isolated pod, if that's what you want to call it. I think it's just the social element as well for me, you know. It's just go around and, you know, might bump into Benji up at the Swan. Well, it's closed now, so that won't be happening anyway. Seeing Terry just getting his pass or whatever outside the ground. So, you know, I mean, it's just little things like that, really, that you probably take for granted. A lot of people probably didn't realise. And yes, I mean, I'm the same as you, mate. I mean, I can't wait for it to start going again. Don't know when that'll be. And I just think it'll be interesting how it pans out, because it's more or less like people having, like, at the end of the season, they're going to have a pre-season, you know? I mean, cause I assume they can't train. Are people still training and not doing what they should be doing? Are they going to have an advantage? I mean, it's going to be interesting. I mean, I'm going to try and find out, see if what sort of things they've been doing and what they've been given on their time off, just to be nosy, really, because it is quite interesting. Yeah. Surely they're not sitting at home in their pants playing FIFA. Surely they're doing something productive.
Yeah, well, that's not what I'm doing. Well, I've done the Joe Weeks stuff, actually. I don't know if anyone's seen the Joe Weeks YouTube workouts. It's basically what you do is you get into your shorts, you set your laptop up, and then you spend 20 minutes calling someone you don't know an absolute dickhead through a screen, and they can't hear you. But you're on the ground going, Joe, you're a dickhead. You're basically out of breath. It's horrible. But, I mean, sort of continuing the point you're making there, Nath, in terms of, because obviously, yeah, you will assume there have to be some form of pre-season, but I guess, does that mean that form will very much go out the window again? And obviously, we don't know how the game will restart. We don't know what it will be in terms of players, because contracts will still be a question that will need to be answered as and when they can. But, I mean, do you think the fact that we're on a three-game losing run, will that have any effect? Because by the time we come back into it, most people have forgotten what our last game is.
Yeah, I don't think it will make a blind bit of difference at all. I think in football, momentum's a massive thing. And I think when you're playing those games, and, you know, we was going to go up to Hull, you know, you are on a three-game losing streak. I know we've got a tight squad and, you know, Bose knows what we can do, but mentally you're still knowing that you're on a three-game losing streak. If it comes about, I don't know, let's say June for the sake of argument, it's like I said, it feels like it's the first game of the season. It's going to be weird and everyone's going to be fresh. Everyone's going to be chomping at a bit to get on and then try and get those 3 points. And I think it's probably, in for people down at our sort of place, it's like in the relegation zone, you're going to be buzzing to keep going now. I think the people that may struggle is the people that were doing really well, is to keep that intensity up. So we can't get any worse, surely, than our run. So I think it'll be a good thing. And like I say, you know, time will tell. But I think it'll be just to have a break, you know, a few weeks off, relax, spend time with your family, come back and let's go again. And I think it'll be all right.
Right, let's bring this first part of the pod then to a close. When we come back, we're going to be delving into a bit of nostalgia, as we have been doing on these isolation-busting pods over the last few weeks.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Trying to take his man on. Chip ball back across. Bowers there. Pierce is there. Bowers with a header. And it's Jones.
Yes!
Oh, it's it! Oh, it's gone! Oh, Patrick Barr! You absolute German beauty! Woo! Dreamland! Charlton have scored! With seconds remaining!
We've done it, too!
Get in! Come on! What a time to be a hero! Here at Wembley! Oh, my word! Oh, my word!
Charlton Live.
Now, we promised you a walk down memory lane, and this week it felt appropriate to share our recollections of the unforgettable 2011-2012 League One campaign. Under the stewardship of the popular Chris Powell, Charlton stormed the division with a record-breaking 101 points to finally clinch promotion back to the Championship at the third attempt. So we'll talk about our memories of that season during the second half of this week's pod, and we've also delved into our archives to bring you a rerun of an interview that the club's former head of comms, Matt Wright, did with Powley a few years back for The Voice of the Valley. The former England international looks back at his first full season in management with real pride.
It's one of real pride and achievement for myself. Well, not only myself, but all the staff and the players, and especially the supporters, because we achieved something that I was told, and you can maybe tell me this, but only three other managers, apart from myself, has won something for Charlton. So, you know, that in itself, something that will stick with me forever and be part of the club's history forever. And it's just the way we done it. Looking back, I think you're so immersed in it, week in, week out, day in, day out, that you kind of don't always look at and recognise exactly how well we did as a football club. You know, it was a rebuilding job on and off, and I mean off in capital letters. I mean, looking back, and you know, I can always tell you the statistics, most of them anyway. You know, 30 wins, 11 draws, 5 losses. I can rally off to you 15 home wins, 15 away wins. You know, and if you really press me, I think I could tell you all the scores, all the scorers virtually, because it was just something that, you know, we hoped for and we planned for. But actually executing it is a different matter. And those players, each and every one of them, did that. You know, and there were times where I suppose people doubted us a little bit, but we were top from September the 17th, and we never left it until the end of the season.
Charlton Live.
So we'll hear clips of the Powley interview, but first of all, let's hear myself, Ben, Nathan and Terry share our memories of that superb campaign. This was, I think it was pretty much one of the first seasons you and I started going to games together, actually, Ben. If I remember rightly, I met you at Walsall away just before Christmas, a game that we ended up drawing 1-1. But, I mean, this was one of those seasons where, I mean, it was just what the first feel-good year we've had in a long, long time. Obviously, we were on a real downward spiral, the relegation from the Premier League, and then the relegation into League One a couple of years later. I mean, we got into the playoffs under Parkey, but then we stagnated the next season. Powley came in. We had a horrendous second half of that year, finishing 13th, I think it was, in League One. But there was this massive clear-out in the summer, this massive rebuilding mission that went on. And then we just went on this superb season where we hit the top of the table early on, and then we never looked back, and so many good memories were made that year, Ben.
Yeah, as you said, probably the best memory was me and you. That was very memorable. In the
in the Saddlers Club.
In the Saddlers Club, that was it, yeah. But yeah, as you said, like, Pal done a phenomenal job with signing all those players and making it work. I mean, I remember at the time so many pundits and journalists were saying, well, look how many players Charlton are signing. That's not going to work. But I remember, I think it was the January before, as you said, but then when our season petered out, I think Powell joined in that January and he signed Bradley Wright Phillips. And as we know with last season, having Lyle Taylor, having that goal scorer in Wright Phillips was a key signing for me. And I know he started to score a few goals, but obviously we petered away that season. But yeah, I think that was the first major signing. And then we came into the summer and just look at some of those signings that then went on to be Premier League footballers like Dale Stevens, Jan, just some of the core part of that team, Danny Hollands, Mike Morrison. Yeah, I mean, how Powley did that, signing all those players and making it work was quite phenomenal for me.
Yeah, I mean, Terry, obviously we sold Carl Jenkinson to Arsenal, which I think just freed up a tiny bit of cash for Powell to go onto this, well, call it a spending spree, but it wasn't remotely a spending spree. It was still very much, he had to do it on a bit of a budget. Sure, we had probably quite a good wage bill for League One, I think, at that time. But if you look at the fact he spent very little money, it was a lot of sort of picking up freebies and players that he didn't have to pay a lot of money for from League One and sort of the cream of the crop. And it showed that Powell really did have a good eye for a player at that time.
I think more importantly for me was the style of player he brought in. It wasn't the fact that, I mean, he almost went back to basics, and he learned from previous Charlton managers as well, notably Alan Kirbishley, when, you know, he bought players that and brought in players that had something to prove. You know, players that had been almost outcast from their previous clubs. Kermigan's a classic example of that. Just players that bought into Charlton, bought into what he wanted the club to achieve, and not just achieve for the club, but achieve for themselves. And so, you know, there was that aura back about the club that we hadn't had for a little while. So, you know, the whole feel-good factor just started from the beginning, really. I mean, even in the bit where he wasn't that successful when he first came in, it was just, there was just a belief back that we didn't have previously. And strangely, I sort of first bought into that, I think, and I mentioned it off air, where, you know, Millwall away in the pre-season friendly, you know, they were a Championship club that not long come down from the top division, I think a couple of seasons before that. And so, you know, we were going to the Den in our last pre-season thinking, well, we're going to get tanked here, we're absolutely going to get mullered, and we really put on a show. And of course it's Millwall, so they beat us right at the last, I think about 5 or 10 minutes to go. But we actually gave them, for a large part of the game, we gave them a footballing lesson, and you just thought, this side could be good, you know, really could be good. And then when the season started, we went on that run, and we're thinking, yes, actually, you know, we could do something here. I remember going up to Rochdale away and sitting in the stands, and there was this, like, 5 or 6 quite large gentlemen sat next to us shouting Dale for the first 5 minutes. I thought, oh my goodness, what's happened here? I've either sat in the wrong place or they've just come in, wind us up. And it turned out it was Dale Stevens' family.
Oh, there you go.
And they were brilliant people, absolutely brilliant. So we actually called it for Dale, not Rochdale. And then we got, I think, didn't we lose to Stevenage or something? We thought, oh, hello, we're going to have a bit of a wobble here. And straight after Stevenage, I think we tonked Carlisle, we then beat Hartlepool before, we were 5-0 up against Preston, you know, and suddenly you're thinking, my word, we could do this, really do this. And there's some sparkling memories of that season, just lots of them.
Yeah, I mean, that defeat at Stevenage, I remember a very frustrating game, if I remember rightly, a massively deflected goal from Stacey Long. But that was our 13th game of the season, the first that we'd lost, Nathan. I mean, that start to that campaign, it really sort of laid down a marker, didn't it? That 3-0 win over Bournemouth on the opening day included a bit of a worldy volley from Scott Wagstaff, if I remember rightly. Then we went, got a couple of away results, not County and Colchester. We were pretty relentless at the start of that season, Nathan, and it really set us up nicely.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even though I remember at the beginning of the season, even it was only the second game against Notts County away. I think it was Paul Hayes' goal
And I think Jan come just after that, I think. But I remember even that game, we thought, I was like, hang about, we could be doing something good here. I know it's only two games in, but you could tell with the players that he brought in, I think the way I look at it is that we were really well balanced. I mean, you had leaders in there. I mean, people obviously speak about Morrow, but you've got people like Matt Taylor, who is a leader. You know, Jacko got, 12, 13 goals that year. You've got little unhidden gems of, you know, Waggy coming in and Bradley Pritchard coming in. And like Terry said, you had a lot of players that had a lot of things to prove. And yeah, I just think we went on that with that crazy run. But it was the first time watching us play all season, to be honest, I have never had a fear of losing. I really didn't. I thought we were invincible that year. Going all the away games, which I think that was that the Rose of Denmark year? I can't remember. But yeah, I just remember going to games thinking, oh, we ain't going to lose today. And it just seemed like the players knew that as well. The players didn't think they were going to lose. So it was a bit of a surreal season, and it's a good season. Amazing season, really. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, there's plenty of memories from that year.
And we'll talk about our favourite specific games later on, because Pally's asked that question as well. But as you mentioned, we did rarely lose. I think we only lost five games that season, which is an incredible for a 46-game season. But when we did lose, we tended to react really well. So after that Stevenage result, we went on and won the next six in the league. Went and lost at Leighton Orient on New Year's Eve after Hamer got sent off early on. Went and won the next four and didn't lose again until March. Then all of a sudden, we just had the slightest of little wobbles. I think we were still like probably 7 or 8 points clear at this time. But we had a home defeat against Colchester, which is in March, our first home defeat of the season. Right, okay, these things happen. Then the next game, we're 4-0 down at home to Notts County at half time. All of a sudden, Ben, were you suddenly thinking, oh God, we're going to do a proper Charlton number here? We're going to properly screw this up.
Yeah, it did seem like that was happening. But I think in the team, we had a good balance of youth and experience, and we had quite a few experienced characters in there. And I remember, I think Andy Hughes came in around that time, around those games, and really, really played a good job in the centre of midfield. And I remember a couple games after that, we had some random players play. I remember Danny and Gessen. I think he popped up with a winner. I think it was either a corner or a cross against Leighton Orient.
Yeah, he got one against Walsall as well, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess, again, that was Pally rotating the squad, going, look, you're kind of not doing it for me now. And I think we got in some loans like him. I don't remember, it was Lee Cook there as well, someone like that. But yeah, I remember we just relied on different players, and after that we kind of came up with the goods in the end. But yeah, it was a nervous time. We were thinking, oh no, because obviously in the old Kirkshire years when we were doing well in the Premiership, it was typical Charlton. Come March time, we fell away. But yeah, we managed to stay there with some help on some different kind of players.
Yeah, and then towards the end of that season, Terry, after we had that slight wobble, so we lost 3 in 5, including a defeat away at Huddersfield, which I remember was quite a frustrating one as well. I think there was a red card in there for, was it Hogan Efran? Or Daryl Russell, in fact, was sent off. But then just towards the end of that season, we just started to grind it out, didn't we? You know, home wins against Leighton Orient and Walsall, and we'll talk about the Oldham game later on, because that'll go down as my favourite one. But we just made sure that we got over the line, and that's where Powdy really sort of came into his own, just made sure that we got enough points just to make sure we got that title at the very end there.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to the characters we had on the side. I mean, Danny Ollins, of course, who was like an enforcer in that midfield. There were games sometimes that passed him by if games were too quick, but generally speaking, Danny Ollins, and Dale Stevens could put a tackle in. He wasn't afraid of getting his foot in, and I think he got a red card some point during the season, pretty sure of it. We just had players that had a bit of bottle and a bit of character, and you're right, whereas at the start of the season we were banging fours and fives and threes and really winning comfortably. Towards the end there, they were all, well, not all, but quite a few of them were 1-0s, 2-0s, 2-1s. We just did enough.
Yeah, certainly. And then, of course, now if we come to that end of season bit where we went up to Carlisle. I don't know if you're up there, Nath, at Carlisle, but I was up there, and we were, you know, again, it was sort of a one we had to grind out. We scored reasonably late on, right, Phillips, from a corner with 14 minutes left to go, and we're waiting for Sheffield Wednesday's result at Colchester as well. But you know, with those scenes when we were finally promoted on Paoli's mum's birthday as well, that'll always go down as one of my all-time favourite Charlton games, that one.
Yeah, no, it was a bit surreal, really. I mean, because it was just nice going into the other games, not sort of worrying about it. I mean, I think we'd done Preston away, all in fancy dress and stuff, and you could just go up and enjoy yourself. But I think throughout the season, it was just, but in a weird way, I didn't actually want the season to end because it was such a good season. I think on the pitch and off the pitch, I think a lot of people started going away. A lot of people made new friends, especially like the Rose of Denmark lot and that. And I think, yeah, in a strange way, I didn't actually want it to end because, you know, not every season's going to be like that. And but yeah, it was full of fond memories back then. And yeah, I mean, what a way to do it. And it was just such a... I was so happy for Paoli. I mean, obviously, before that, I mean, I still remember him scoring against Coventry on his last game, you know, and it's just mad. And it was just so... When he came in, I was like, you know, do you really want to put a legend in charge? You know, because what happens if it don't go well? And obviously, the last two in Bowes and Paoli, it's not turned out too bad, has it? But, it was a great year, great season, and... I don't think it'll probably get topped for a while anyway.
Yeah, and Party Time, obviously, wasn't it, against Wickham and Hartlepool, the home games there, and the away game at Preston, as you mentioned, we went up in fancy dress. But Ben, I mean, that Wickham game where we were confirmed as champions, and that game against Hartlepool where we received the trophy, I mean, you especially think about the spells we'd been through at the time, which obviously... Still pretty much going on now, really. But at the time, it felt like we finally were on the way back. And we'll talk a bit more later on in the show about how we weren't, unfortunately, in the end. But at that time, it really felt like everything was finally coming together again.
Yeah, I think that Hartlepool game, especially having a sellout crowd to watch us become champions, and we had that amazing... performance from the Red Arrows bringing down. Did they bring down the? No,
yeah.
They brought down the match ball.
I think.
I was thinking the trophy then. I thought that would be interesting. Drop that. But yeah, and then Jan scored that quite amazing goal against Hartlepool. Not sure how he scored that, but yeah, as you said, we were buzzing. As Nate said, we all had made such great new friends, and off the field it felt so good as on the field. And and we had some quite great players in the team. And yeah, we thought, here we go. This is us finally getting back to where we should be.
Excellent stuff. So, all right, let's go back to Paoli then. Let's bring Chris Powell back into the show. His interview he did with Matt Wright a number of years ago. Obviously, we talked about the rebuilding of the squad at the start of this piece. And during this little excerpt from the interview, Paoli was talking about how important it was that he got the rebuilding of the squad right.
Charlton Live.
It started during that season. I tell you when it really had to... sort of come to fruition was after we played Dagenham at Woodbridge. Because I'd never seen Charlton fans like that in my lifetime. You know, we had some down times when I was a player, but we had more good times, and whenever we had a downturn in results or performances, we seemed to rally around one another, and the club always came together. But Dagenham, and walking towards the fans, down that tunnel, and the abuse we got, you know, and I almost shy away from it, and, you know, I'm not going to pinpoint anyway. You know, I think it was that sort of nadir moment where everyone went, well, how low can we get? And that's not just Dagenham, the flake went on the day and earned the right to beat us 2-1. But that was it. That was a moment I remember getting on the coach and being sort of really not alone, because I've always had good staff in Alex and Damien and Ben and, you know, Phil Chappell and Errol at the time, but we needed to change. And I just said, you know, we need to change everything, and we need to do it as soon as we can. And we need to just get through to the end of the season and really make some big decisions, some harsh decisions. You know, someone like Jose Semedo was player of the year, and a real likeable guy, but I just felt we needed to be fair to him and be fair to us. we needed to move on and create a new team, create a new squad and a new feeling. So after Dagenham, it was Phil, chief scout at the time, and I spoke to Pete Varney and Steve Kavanagh and said, look, we need to come together and make a real change and have some players that just haven't been affected by all what's gone on. Because quite clearly, everyone's been affected. And I don't want new players mixing in with old players that are affected by it. I just want the fans to kind of say, okay, that part of our history is gone. Let's move on and see if we can create new heroes, a new feeling, a new team, and, you know, hopefully some real sort of passion and history that everyone would be proud of. And, you know, we did that. So we started looking at what players we could get in from clever free transfers. Selling Carl Jenkinson was an added bonus. I managed to use the money to buy Royce Wiggins and Dale Stevens and Danny Green. There was a little bit left over, just sort of real small fees to Michael Morrison and Ben Hamer. And then we brought in some good fees. Matt Taylor came in, Danny Hollands on a free. Obviously, we utilised what players were there, Johnny Jackson, Scott Wagstaff, Chris Solly. So all of a sudden, you know, we started to build a team and a squad that really didn't have any attachment to what had gone on before. And all they saw was Charlton Athletic, a well-supported club, a fantastic stadium, good infrastructure, that used to be in the Premier League, now in League One, but want to get back there. They all bought into it. So that was sort of my USP with a lot of the players. Whenever I met them, and I met them, you know, during the course of the tail end of that season, and obviously throughout my summer, I grabbed a holiday, but I was on the phone all the time, and I remember meeting Tony on my holiday as well. And that's what we had to do. You know, straight away we knew that the two Sheffield clubs would have bigger budgets and would have squads that were used to League One. We knew Preston and Huddersfield would have a budget bigger than us. So we knew we had to be a bit creative, rely on a few younger players like Chris, like Scott, and marry that with some good experience at the level, and some clever, astute buys that would also gain in value, like a Wiggins, like a Steve. So that was the way we went about it, and what system we would play, and get players to fit into what we were going to do that season.
Was there a conscious decision to bring in leaders?
Yeah. Well, there definitely was, because if you remember, Samino was captain, and he was, again, more a leader by example. Jacko, I was just getting to know. But yeah, Michael Morris and I played alongside, and always felt he had leadership qualities, even from when he was playing at Leicester, when he joined from Cambridge. One player you didn't mention there, Matt Taylor, was next, you know. Danny Hollands had been captain, he was a bit quieter than what we thought, but there were players we felt could grow. Chris Solly, leader by example. Jan Kermagat, when he came in, leader by example. Brad was a leader by example with Dale. I thought had qualities that he could possibly be a captain. So our spine was good with central leaders, and obviously I had a decision to make with regards to Matt Taylor or Jacko. I think during the course of the pre-season, I'm sure some eagle-eyed fans will remember, I made a different player captain for all the games during the pre-season. So I had Jacko captain, I had Danny Holland as captain, I had Matt Taylor as captain, I think I gave Chris Solly the armband for pre-season game. It's just so I didn't want pressure on anyone. I wanted to get to know them. And in the end, there were two outstanding candidates at that time in Jacko and Matt Taylor. And I suppose the rest is history of Jacko in the end, because I just felt he would relate more to the fans and it would just take a bit of pressure away from Matt Taylor, who was a new player. And they were a bunch that almost managed themselves. Of course, I had to reel them in a few times, as you do. And listened, and they really bought into it. And, I'd be amazed if I get another group like that in my managerial lifetime.
Charlton Live.
Let's talk about our favourite specific games from that season, because of course there's so many to choose from, and I'm sure if you've been going through and watching that replay of the season on the club's website. Then you'll be having your own personal ones. But I want to bring in the guys to find out what their ones are from that campaign. So, Benji, I'll bring you in first. If you could narrow it down to a game or two from that campaign, there's so many to pick from. What would you say was your favourite from that year?
I'm going to say, just because there was a big build-up going into it, I think it was Monday night on Sky Sports, us beating Huddersfield 2-0 to end their unbeaten run. I can't remember how many games
it was. About 43 games, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was quite a lot. They had Lee Clark as their manager. He was quite mouthy, wasn't he? And then they had Jordan Rhodes up front, and I think he was banging form at the time. So, I think we were 2-0 up at half-time, and I just remember Hogan Ephraim's goal just before half-time. I think we shot, it was deflected, and he scored the rebound or something like that. Great finish. And I just remember Monday night, obviously, the Valley was rocking on an evening game, but also I remember picking up the Evening Standard the next day, turned over back page, and Ephraim's celebration was the whole of the back page. So I was like, oh, brilliant. Like, we're finally getting some plaudits of what we're doing. And I think that went on to kind of think, do you know what? Charlton are big this season. I think they're going to go places. And it made people kind of like look out for us then. And as Nate said earlier, that's when we kind of got confidence as fans and as the players' confidence grew. Because obviously Huddersfield on this unbeaten run, and then we just beaten them. It kind of gave us that confidence and that awe around us to think, do you know what? Here we go. We can do this now.
Yeah, it laid down a real marker, didn't it? I remember Jan Kermigan opening the score. And I'm just looking through. I mean, I've got a website up here, and this can't be right, surely. According to according to the stats for that game, they had 10 corners and we had none. But I don't know if that's correct or not. But you're right, it laid down a real marker. And obviously, a lot had been made about Huddersfield's unbeaten run that wasn't an unbeaten run, because they had lost in the playoff final the season before. I can't remember who they played against. Peterborough, wasn't it? Old Trafford. But a lot had been made about it. And for us to go out there and to end it quite comfortably, I know they had a bit. I remember they had a bit of a resurgence in the second half without being able to get one past Ben Hamer, but it went to show that we really did have an opportunity now to finish at the top of that league.
Yeah, as you said, yeah, I think there were some other big teams around. I think that season I enjoyed the rivalry. I think we had a good rivalry with the two Sheffield clubs, and then we kind of had one over on Huddersfield now, so it felt like we were really, the era was buzzing. But yeah, I think it just showed what kind of squad depth we had around. Of just looking at the team sheet as well, we had Darryl Russell in there. I mean, you had forgot he played. I know he scored one goal against Preston as well, but just looking through the team sheet, Ryan Phillips and Kermigan up front, Paul Hayes came on, Hogan Ephraim. I think you kind of, if you look back on that season, you'd forget about some players like Hogan Ephraim, but I think that was the whole camaraderie of the squad that Powell had, that he could bring in different players if we had injuries, and they all played their part. And I remember hearing some of the interviews from the players, the whole, as I say, the whole camaraderie, the whole banter between the players was so good, and I think that echoed in the performances that we saw.
Excellent stuff. Right, so let's bring in Terry then. Obviously, you've been to many games over the course of your Charlton supporting career, but if you could pick some favourites from that season, which one would you go for?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it before about a Millwall pre-season game, and that sticks in my head purely because of the way we played, and that sort of gave me some confidence going into the season. And the lads, I mean, Benji's already mentioned a couple that stick in their head. The good thing about that season is it's very difficult to pick one, because it was such a good season, and you feel a bit guilty only picking one of them. So, you know, the ones that stick out, I guess, for varying different reasons. I mean, we had the Bournemouth away. That was the weekend, but not we can't mention what happened at the weekend, obviously. But the game itself, I think we were awful, as I remember. We'd beaten Bournemouth beginning of the season, so maybe we went down there with a little bit of complacency, I don't know. But, you know, we were absolutely awful down there, as I remember. But we still managed to nick it with a Jan Kermigan goal right at the end, you know, right at the death.
Yeah, just bobbled over the line, didn't it?
Yeah, we stole it 1-0, and we did steal it. And we just thought then that, this bodes well. If we can come down here, play that awful and still win, that really sticks in the mind. As does the Preston away, because we all went up there in fancy dress and all that sort of stuff. But I think that the one game that really, I suppose, and I think Nathan might say something similar, the one that really sticks in the head, purely because, well, two actually, the Sheffield Wednesday away, because beating Sheffield Wednesday away is always fun, because they don't take it very well. But I remember, you know, we were up against Jose Semedo, who was, of course, once of our parish. And they couldn't handle us beating them either. We went 1-0 up fairly early, and in a half hour, Johnny Jackson, I think, scored it, I'm pretty sure. And they got angry, basically. I think they had like most of their team booked because they just couldn't take us beating them. And even though it was only 1-0, they just couldn't handle it.
And do you remember when they brought on Miguel Lera off the bench as well? And obviously he had a bit of a...
Yeah.
A haphazard. I mean, he was all right. I think I grew to like him by the end. But we did.
He was a lovely fella, by the way.
We knew he buckled under pressure. And I remember when he came on, the entire away end started singing Miguel Lera, "He Ain't Got a Clue." And his first clearance, he absolutely sliced it out for a throw-in when he was trying to do a crossfield ball to the other side. So I remember sticking it on him as well.
It was a great day out, but I mean that one. But I think the other one that has to be mentioned, and I'm pretty sure Nathan might mention it as well, is the FA Cup game away to Fulham. Yeah, yes, we got absolutely tonked by a Premier League side. But firstly, you know, the scoreline flattered them hugely. I thought we played much better than the 4-0 that suggested otherwise. But the fact that we completely sold out that other end and never stopped singing from minute one right to the end, it was the day of the boats up the Thames. It was just a cracking day out. And I think what it did, even though we got beat, and even though I think it was on the telly, and people, if they hadn't seen the game, would have thought, hello, little old Charlton getting absolutely spanked. But I think what it did for me is it showed that we weren't little old Charlton anymore. You know, we were sort of back to where, you know, we had a full house away at Fulham. We outsung them. There are times we played some lovely football. And so it just had a feel-good factor about it, you know, and just summed up the season for me that Chrissy Powell had brought Charlton back to where we wanted it to be.
Yeah, that was a great day, even despite the result. And as you say, I remember, I think we were in the Spoons in Greenwich for about 8 o'clock in the morning for breakfast, and then we were still out and about in Greenwich after, well, late into the night. I remember that very well. That was a great day.
It was like we'd won it. It was bizarre. You know, yeah. You met people going home, and you were all happy and singing and laughing. Oh, where have you been? Oh, we've just been to Crown Cottage, Charlton FA Cup. Oh, did you win? No, got spanked.
yeah, great memories. And Nathan, then, so if you had to pinpoint one from that day.
It's like Tel was saying, there's loads of games really that you could have picked, but I mean, yeah, going on the Fulham one, obviously the banter boat, which is, you know, we were due to do to Brentford in a couple of weeks time, but that'll be moved, but for me, I think the one that stood out for me in terms of intent and maybe got a lot of the other teams in the division sitting up a little bit and go, oh, hang about, is when we went to Bramall Lane, we beat them 2-0. I think Jan and Brad have scored in the second half quite close together, and I think we had that game there is, I don't know, is that the game, that weren't the game when Pally come on the pitch at the end or anything, was it?
That's at Bramall Lane, yeah, and he had the huddle with all of them at full time, yeah.
And that's the one that really sticks out, because I thought that was, even though all year, I mean, from the beginning, I thought we were doing something, you'd always have that element of doubt going, well, we are Charlton, we never do it easy, da-da-da-da-da-da. But that was the one game where I sat back and thought, you know what, we've got a chance here.
Yeah.
And
Jan scoring with his first touch was amazing as well.
It, ex- Exactly, and I think even if you look at Bramall Lane, there was 20-odd thousand there, and then if you look at all the other sort of games, we had a few, the 20,000, but to get 20,000 in League One, that was a big game. The atmosphere was fierce, and they were expected to win. And just to do the double, I mean, I don't like Wednesday anyway. I'm not, you know, I don't mind Sheffield United, as you know. But yeah, like, what a game that was. And I just think that showed real intent.
Mm.
And so it proved.
Yeah.
And the Fulham banner boat was absolute banner. I don't think I've ever been so drunk at a football game ever, I don't think.
Yeah, I think I was.
I ain't even lying.
Yeah, I think
I
was
the game too much.
Literally and metaphorically in the same boat there. Yeah, no, that was a great day. Now, obviously, I should add my own one into the mix. And I think it was mentioned by someone earlier on, but the away win at Oldham on the 7th of April was the day of the boat race, funnily enough, actually. I remember watching that in the pub. I think they had it on in the pub when we were there. But it was just one of those days. We ground out a 1-0 win with nine men. Where it was another one of those where you thought, we're definitely winning this league, you know, if we can do that. I think Danny Hollins was sent off sort of early on. Half an hour in for a lunge. I thought it was maybe slightly harsh. Trevor Kettle, of course, was the referee. Then Oldham had their own chap sent off about 5 minutes before half-time. Then 3 or 4 minutes into the second half, this amazing run down the left-hand side from Royce Wiggins. He dug out across to the far post, but there's still plenty for Jan to do. But he headed it into the bottom corner. And you're thinking, right, let's just hang on. And then Scott Wagstaff got a second yellow card for falling over. When he tried to make a challenge must have been just outside the area because it wasn't a penalty. And he got sent off, and then we were hanging on for the last 15 minutes. And I just remember Oldham just absolutely pummeling us, you know, sending long balls into the penalty area. But this was where another one of perhaps that season's unsung heroes in Leon Court was playing alongside Michael Morrison in defence. And he won absolutely everything in the air that day. And we clung on to win the game with nine men. And that was a real statement of intent. And Terry, I bring Leon Court was certainly one of those players who perhaps sort of went a little bit under the radar that season. But he showed the sort of depth we had in that squad and the sort of reliability you could bring in from the wings for big games that season.
Yeah, absolutely, and he wasn't alone. I mean, you're right. Then we had a squad of players that, I think it was Benji mentioned before, we brought some players in like Danny and Gesson and Lee Cook and Daryl Russell and was it Hogan Frame was the other one.
He just seemed
to pick up the odd gem as well. And again, I go back to what I said earlier: players with something to prove. And Leon Court was definitely one of those, I think. And we just had something about us. I remember. He did an interview, and I don't think it was in the same one. Forgive me if I've gone over what's already been said by Chrissy Powell. But one of the first things he did when he came in is he saw the training ground, and he saw the split in the training ground, where everybody had all different tables. So there were little groups, little pockets of players all dotted about, rather than everybody getting in together. So the first job he did was get rid of all the little tables and make one big one. Because he wanted everybody to be part of the same collective, so everybody to be talking to each other, not just like little pockets of Spaniards or little pockets of English or little pockets of Welsh. You know what I mean? So, and I think that was the characteristic he brought. Any club that came in had to mix in, had to be part of the whole ethos of the club. And Leon Colts just summed that up. And you're right, that game was immense.
Right, well, let's have a listen. We've told you what our favourite games were. Let's now find out what Powley thought was the most important game from that season.
Charlton Live.
Yeah, I mean, everyone talks about the Sheffields, and rightly so. I mean, that was basically Jacko's week. Sheffield Wednesday away, Sheffield United at home. I think that really put so much belief in the brains of everyone, players and fans alike. So I think that was crucial. I think even, you know, going away and winning at Hartlepool, that was a three-game week. Those sort of weeks really propel you or can make you have a downward turn when you have three-game weeks.
Mm.
You know, getting 9 points is utopia. Getting seven is good. Getting six, okay, sometimes you can say that. It's a difficult game that you've lost. But anything less than that, you tend to think, well, okay, that's not great. But to get nine and going all that way was massive for us. I think, you know, beating Preston 5-2.
Yeah, that was the game after Hartlepool.
Yeah, you know, all of a sudden, scoring goals, we showed people that we mean business. And remember, this is a new group that hadn't really, you know, most people say they have to an together and get to know one another. But they just clicked straight away. They got to understand what I was. And they done it. We kept it very simple. And if we had any setbacks, we would quickly do our best to rectify them as a group. You know, those results, I think, will always give any team, new or old, belief in what they're doing. And we just went on from there. And, you know, winning sort of in the last minute away at Yeovil on Boxing Day. They're just big, big moments. And then I think whenever we had a setback, we tended to bounce back straight away with either a draw or a win. So after Stevenage, you know, we got a positive result. I can't remember who it was. But I remember, you know, we lost to Orient. We went down to 10 men, then got sent off early on. And then we got a result 2 days later. And I think a real test for us was when we lost to Colchester and Notts County. Yeah, the Notts County result, I mean, no one saw that coming at all. That was a bit of a test, and we drew up at Scunthorpe
yep.
the next game, which was important. I didn't want 2 in a row, and they were both at home, which was a disappointment. But, you know, the players rallied round one another and handled the pressure. We were top, we were there to be shot at, so we got back and went on from there. But I think winning at Oldham, I think was the one for me. I know it was close then, we were close to sort of the results, what we wanted, but winning at Oldham with, if we go down to 9 and they went down to 10, was, that was just huge. That just showed me then that this group could actually do anything. They were committed. Whatever was put in front of them, they were knocking it down, and they were knocking it down together. Whether it's 11, 10, or in that case, 9, that moment then, just said to me on that drive home, you know, this group will stop at nothing. They want this trophy. They want this promotion. They want it on their CV.
Charlton Live.
So there we go, Powley talking about his favourite game from that season. Now, before we go into the final excerpt, which is Powley talking about some frustration as to what didn't happen next, the fact we didn't quite build upon it. I mean, let's talk about that ourselves, Ben. Obviously, we were in this situation. I think we'd seen Norwich City go from League One to the Premier League in 2 seasons, maybe just the year before. So we were suddenly thinking, oh, I wonder if we can do that. But this is when it all started to come apart at the seams with one of the previous ownerships, the Jimenez and Slater and cash regime. You know, they run out of cash, it turned out. And we were unable to build upon it. And then we saw that summer, before we went into the Championship, we were unable to make many signings. And, I mean, now, it just, again, you know, knowing what would come after with Roland, it's so frustrating now that we were unable to build upon the momentum that we had at that time.
Yeah, you've hit a nail on the head there. You see a lot of teams that did, I think Leicester did it as well, didn't they? They did 2 leagues in a row and were back in up in the big time. But it was gutting to see us being held back. Again, we had players there with huge potential. Dale Stevens, and I know Jan was coming towards his later years of his career, but another person who had who went on to be one of the leading strikers in the Championship. So yeah, it was gutting to see. We were waiting for some signings just to add to the squad, the great squad we had already, and it just didn't come. I remember we signed one of your favourite players in Simon Church, but again, we were looking for just a little bits to add to the squad. And I know Powley said that he knew towards the end of that title winning season that the funds weren't going to come to help us push on. And again, we were lucky to survive in the end from hearing what actually happened behind the scenes. So, just real frustration because it just held us back. And we see so many times where these teams do push on and then make the next move. And who knows? We could have been up in that promised land of Premiership if we would have had the funding.
Yeah, Terry, is that one of your major frustrations that we had this chance to push on and build upon that feel-good factor that Pally had brought back, and then we were just... I mean, we had an all right season in the end the next year, finishing ninth, although against all the odds. But then it was the season after where we saw how this squad had stagnated a bit when we started to really struggle, and obviously that in the end ended up with just a brush with only just staying up under Roland, funnily enough, when he came in. But it's such a shame that we never... Because you do wonder where Pally could have taken us as well with that. He's sort of at his home club almost.
It's the huge unanswered question in recent times, isn't it? I mean, we saw what he did in League One by, you know, turning around a squad of about 20-odd players afresh and doing what we did there. We finished ninth the following season and that weren't that far away from the playoffs, really. I mean, I can't remember exactly how many points it was, but it was half a dozen rings a bell. I don't know if that's true, but, you know, we weren't that far away, and you just think if he was able to add to it or do in the Championship in the similar way that he did in League One, not quite so many players would have been necessary, but just a few, where we could have gone from there. As you say, so many other sides have gone back to back, and you just get the feeling it was distinctly possible. You know, it's momentum, isn't it? A lot of people talk about it, and it's an overword, an overused phrase generally, but we had it. You know, we had momentum, we had the feel good factor of getting promoted as champions. Not comfortably, is probably overstretching it, but we were good for it and worthy of it. And then we go into the following season, and everybody knows it's going to be tough, of course it is, but to get that close with very little financial assistance for Chris Powell, you just get the feeling that it could have been so much better.
Yeah, and Nathan, I guess it makes you wonder what to what extent that possibly stalled Chris Powell's managerial career as well, because of course he ended up getting let go by Roland when a lot of fans felt he shouldn't, and I myself were included in that. Went to Huddersfield, where again he sort of steadied the ship, and then they let him go. And you know, Southend, he went into a Southend club, the side that's clearly on a downward spiral as a club itself, has had all sorts of problems since then. You'd have to say the fact he wasn't able to build upon that success he had at Charlton probably put the muckers a bit on his fledgling managerial career, because he'd had such a good start to it, but he was never able to build upon that momentum or then go into a club where there was momentum to build upon.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. I felt sorry for Christie, obviously, when he left. I mean, like Terry said, to come up and finish ninth, you know, I think we beat Barnsley 6-0 that year, and everyone was pulling together, and obviously memories of obviously a beaker with my favourite football chant in the world. I love that song. Just great memories. And then I think the problem with Pally is when he left, I mean, for someone to take a punt on him, he's only second full year maybe in it. And maybe some chairman thought maybe it was a bit of a, not a fluke, but, you know, like, he's only had one job, do we want to give him this? And he ended up getting jobs, like you say, at Huddersfield and that, and it didn't really work out for him. But, yeah, I mean, you can always sit there and go, oh, you know, what it could have been. But I mean, he's working now. I assume he's still with Pards and he down in over in Holland. But yeah, that's a shame. It is a big shame. But especially the season after, where, like you said earlier, we stagnated and we just needed that fresh blood sort of thing. Really, just that sprinkling of additions to try and push us on. And unfortunately, it wasn't. But nevertheless, you know, there's so many memories that Pauly gave us. I'll never forget them.
Right, we're going to hear the clip of Pauly talking about his regrets as to what didn't happen next at the Valley. But I think I'm going to sign off with you guys now. Look, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the phone for this week's Charlton Live, Ben, Nathan, Terry, and hopefully I'll speak to you guys again soon.
Cheers, mate. I have nice weather tomorrow. Make sure you go out and listen to this iPod. This podcast will be lovely, jumbly.
I'm going to go and talk to some plants now. It seems to be the thing to do.
Charlton Live.
You know, I look at Bournemouth, I look at Eddie Howe, and I look at the journey he's had with them, and I always think that could have been us at Charlton. I always do, because he was given a chance at a club that he was affiliated with. Was manager of a real tough period initially, got through it, just like, you know, I did initially, and then he was allowed to build and grow, which all managers want, and if you're given that time, you get that back in, like we did in that first full season, then all of a sudden you're on that journey, you're on that road that you want to be on, then you need to add that back into style. And that's what I felt was the trick we missed, was we had that first season in the Championship, and don't get me wrong, at times when we lost to Middlesbrough, and you know, things weren't looking great for us, and then the infamous Cardiff game, you know, we only lost 5 games on the road that year. Sometimes people don't remember that. You know, 5 games in the Championship on the road. It was brilliant. Of course, we got some results that went for us. I remember being sort of Leeds and Wolves last minute, and John Obika doing, you know, what he did, but, you know, we got some really good results, you know, but the writing was sort of on the wall there. You know, I was told I was going to spend millions and all that. Obviously, it was a load of nonsense. You know, I signed Dorian De Witt on a free. You know, Salim Kerkar after a trial. You know, this was us trying to build. You know, and I just look back on the side that has done that. Like Southampton when they went up, they had that momentum. Like Bournemouth when they went up, and when they went up the season after, and they consolidated and went up. I wanted us to do the same. And we didn't, and sadly, progressively, it got worse. And you know, I do look back with a touch of sadness, really, because everything was with us. The fans were coming back, they were back in their numbers, and, you know, the players were happy, but the change started to happen then. You know, Jackson, Kerman, Gamble were all promised new deals, and we went up and stayed up. They did that, and then just felt, well, what's happened? All of a sudden, it kept happening. You know, these key players were all of a sudden going to be out of contract, and of course, the rest is history. So, you know, you have to look back with fondness on that year, which I always do. It's forever with me now, which is brilliant. I'd love to do it again, you know, with a side, and who knows where that may happen again. And, you know, that's something that, you know, I look back with complete fondness. You know, fans will forever talk about that season because of all the great moments in that season. When you look back, there's so many massive moments in games, in individual performances, team performances, individual goals. You know, yeah, scoring that goal at home to Hartlepool at the end of the season, I mean, you couldn't have written it. You just couldn't have written that sort of goal right at the end of the season. But they all, every single one of them contributed. Every single one. You know, there's not one player throughout that squad that season that didn't contribute. Every single one of them did. And that will be with me for, well, so I leave this place. I don't know how to put that. Maybe don't put it like that.
Charlton Live.
So there we go, that's the end of this week's Charlton Live podcast. Hope you've enjoyed it. Great to hear from Chris Powell, of course, as we took a stroll down memory lane. Thank you to Nathan, to Terry and to Benji for joining me on this week's pod. I've been Louis Mendez and I look forward to speaking to you again next weekend. Have a good one.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.